Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's recent discovery that dropping bombs and threatening war distracts the public and the press from the inquiries into collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians, and the many questions yet to be answered about Trump and his team's financial ties to oligarchs close to Putin. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to analyze the latest explosive revelations from the former British MP Louise Mensch, who claims intelligence sources say that Carter Page went to Moscow with a videotape of Donald Trump offering Putin a change in U.S. policy to Russia in exchange for his help in hacking our election. We will investigate this and other claims that General Flynn was compromised by the Russians and coordinated with Putin to have fake news created by the Russian state fed into the campaign to hurt Hillary Clinton and help Trump. Then we'll get a further analysis of the narrow victory in Sunday's referendum in Turkey, with European election monitors questioning the legitimacy of the results, while the winner, Turkey's new dictator for life, President Erdogan, admonishes them imperiously with "Know your place." Nicholas Danforth, a senior policy analyst for the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center, joins us to discuss his new report from the Bipartisan Policy Center, "Dark Cloud of Illegitimacy Hovers Over Turkey Vote," and Trump's call congratulating Erdogan, which undercuts the European case against Erdogan. Then finally, we will examine alternatives to the collision course the U.S. is on with North Korea as its regime warns that thermonuclear war could break out at any minute. Adam Mount, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who was the project director at the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by former chairman of the Joint Chiefs Admiral Mullen and former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, joins us to discuss their new report, "A Sharper Choice on North Korea, Engaging China for a Stable Northeast Asia." And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Scott. And I'm getting back to you because I wanted to – I'd like to be able to talk to Louise Mensch, but she's laying low and not doing interviews. But she's still putting out some pretty provocative stuff on her blog. But let's just do some context here. Clearly, the Russian Trump story is not going away in spite of the fact that Donald Trump has very, I think, skillfully managed to get it off the headlines – sending cruise missiles into Syria, certainly took it off the headlines. Dropping a big bomb in Afghanistan took it off the headlines. And tensions over North Korea, which are continuing, will keep it off the headlines. But that doesn't mean it's going away. And of course, we all have to add to that that after James Comey and Mike Rogers had the first public hearing of the House Intelligence Committee, that was devastating to the White House, and clearly Trump freaked out, and they managed to get Devin Nunes to basically blow up the entire House Intelligence Committee and make it dysfunctional just ahead of a appearance by the acting Attorney General Sally Yates, former head of the CIA Brennan, and the former DNI General Clapper. So let's look at that first. Do you think that the Trump people have basically sidetracked the Russian investigation, or is it sort of still percolating there on the back burner?
Well, I think they effectively sidetracked the House version at some cost. So I think there was a response to that, which I believe was orchestrated by General McMaster, who was furious about the fact that his staffers were used in this effort with Devin Nunes to shut down the committee. And from what I understand, he insisted that a number of people be fired or removed, and that's included Steve Bannon and KT McFarlane and three more junior people. I think all that happened, and Devin Nunes was removed from management of the Russia investigation. So I think it happened at some cost. On the other hand, the Senate investigation went forward, and, you know, there we had a very important hearing at which the Republicans actually asked some of the toughest and most difficult questions. And in the meantime, last week, while there was distraction, I think most attention focused on Korea, Syria, and Afghanistan during the last 2 weeks. Nevertheless, there appears to have been further breakthroughs achieved in the investigation, and we have The Guardian and several other British papers reporting that the investigation has produced substantive, corroborated evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence. So that's quite important. And they also disclosed, I guess, in the last week, quite a bit of detailed information about how the whole counterintelligence investigation got started, with it being clear that it got started on an initiative that came from the UK and from European allies, not from inside the United States. So all those interesting things. So slowed down, not derailed.
Well, but you do get the impression that even the Senate inquiry is moving at glacial speed. So I'm just wondering whether the Trump people are just slow walking this thing to death. But nevertheless, I wanted to talk to you about some of the extraordinary stuff that Louise Mensch is publishing. And my understanding is that one of her sources has been the former head of GCHQ, Robert Hennigan, who was recently fired. And my understanding is that the Trump people leaned on Theresa May to get him fired. I don't know whether that's true or not. He denies it, of course. But what's your sense of her sources? Because we'll get to what she's reporting, but what she's reporting is pretty explosive.
Well, the Hennigan bit and why he came to be removed on Inauguration Day of Donald Trump, that's a fascinating story we haven't heard the end of. And, you know, the rumors that he was fired to try to appease Trump have swirled around for some time. Of course, he very vigorously contests that, saying that he left at his own request because of needs of family. But that's, I don't know, that's a sort of a very conventional response. But coming to Louise Mensch, she's a difficult case, isn't she? I mean, you know, she's come up with some of the most explosive and validated the disclosures in this investigation so far. No doubt about that. No doubt that she has very good connections with the intelligence community, both in the UK and the US. But on the other hand, she's also a conspiracy theorist, and she's put out some, and so she has released nuggets of very good new information, and this winds up being commingled with speculation. Some of the speculation's well-informed. Some of it's not well-informed. Some of it's contradictory. Some of it is just plain and obviously wrong. So, you know, she's a frustrating source to deal with. I have to say I rather wish that Louise Mensch would write less and would be more careful about what she wrote.
Well, let's talk about what she's just put out on April the 16th. Carter Page went to Moscow with a tape of Donald Trump offering treason for hacking. And that's pretty extraordinary. That's the charge, that Carter Page literally went to Moscow with a pre-recorded tape of Donald Trump offering to change American policy if he were to be elected, to make it more favorable to Putin. In exchange, Page was authorized directly by Trump to request the help of the Russian government in hacking the election. So that would be the smoking gun of all smoking guns, right? That videotape.
That would be absolutely explosive. And, you know, let's back up here and say, you know, what's happened in the last 3 weeks? There have been a series of disclosures about Carter Page specifically. And those disclosures have completely demolished both his statements about what he did in Russia in July of 2016 and the explanations that came from the Trump campaign about what he did. So the claims that he was there on personal business, that's destroyed. I mean, it was discovered, of course, that the Trump campaign approved his going there and that they paid for parts of his visit. His claim was originally that he went there just to give a talk at commencement at a school. There was nothing beyond that. He had no meetings with Russian political figures. He certainly never discussed any concessions Trump may have made. And now, under very aggressive and hostile questioning, in which he's been presented with evidence to the contrary, he's backed away from those claims. So I think that lays the opening for exactly this sort of disclosure. I mean, what was he doing there? Now, by way of background, of course, Christopher Steele states in one of his most explosive memoranda that he had a meeting with Yegor Sechin, who was the head of Rosneft, and there was a discussion about getting Trump a slice of the Rosneft offering of 19.5% equity, which ultimately went to Glencore and the Qatari Investment Fund. He's denied that, and he continues to deny that. But we're now dealing with a situation in which his denials are not credible. And there seems to be a very clear focus by the Intelligence Committee on him. And indeed, we also know he was the unidentified male one in a Russian espionage prosecution in Manhattan. And he has admitted that he had, as was alleged in that case, he had numerous meetings with Russian espionage agents and provided them with materials. And as the surveillance recordings filed in that case show, he was viewed by them as an intelligence asset. So all this looks really terrible for Carter Page and for the Trump camp having used them. And it makes the claims that Louise Mensch has put forward, which I think a year ago would have been viewed as completely absurd, now it makes them look like something that just can't be dismissed quickly.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. The other piece of information, data dumping, that's come out from Louise Mensch on April 16th, Mike Flynn treason tour, global Russian propaganda coordinated with Trump. And this makes the case that, according to her sources and within the intelligence community, Michael Flynn was coordinating with and for Russian agents the drafting of messages that Vladimir Putin was using to attack democracy, not only in the United States, but across Europe. And she gets further into details that involve Cambridge Analytica and how much they were able to disseminate fake news. But it takes it even further, and that is that this fake news that helped elect Trump here in the United States was actually created by Russian-directed propaganda, and the targeting of voters with extraordinary precision was done through Cambridge Analytica, which, of course, Steve Bannon sits on the board, and it's owned by Robert Mercer, the biggest donor to the Trump campaign. And then on top of that, of course, Sir Richard Dealove, the former head of MI6, has told the Financial Times, first of all, that there's incontrovertible evidence to suggest that the Russians were involved in hacking the elections on Trump's behalf. But he also apparently, Dealove, left a dining club at Cambridge because he thought there was too much influence from Dmitry Firtash, who's this corrupt oligarch who is Paul Manafort's patron. He apparently donated $6 million to Cambridge. And also, Michael Flynn had spent some time there at Cambridge University, and where he's consorting with a young woman who looks as though she was an FSB honey trap. So let's start with the general premise that she's putting forth here, that a lot of the fake news that Trump used was actually manufactured in Russia in coordination with the Trump campaign.
I think there seems to be little doubt that that's correct, but it seems that most of the bots that were deployed for this purpose are in Macedonia, Montenegro, Bulgaria, and the Balkans, rather than in Russia per se. But it does seem to be an operation that was funded, set up, and run by the Russians. So that's correct. Now, what strikes me is a little, and it's also very clear that Flynn did go on the sort of tour she describes, and that he was interacting with a number of other figures with what they call ethno-nationalist right groups, who were being supported by the Kremlin. So that's correct. What strikes me as a little bit more doubtful in all of this is the suggestion that he would have played a key role in political messaging. That just doesn't strike me as correct, because I don't think he has the correct background or sensitivities for that sort of work.
So what's the story then with how much he was compromised and perhaps got into a honey trap with this young Russian lady at Cambridge University?
I predict we're going to hear a lot more about that in the next couple of weeks. You read the story. So we've had, I think, a very important story in the Financial Times that you referred to. A story in the Financial Times, in fact, that ran back in December of last year about a Russian infiltration of that Cambridge discussion group. And I think that focused in part on the same woman named Svetlana, who had a liaison with Flynn. I think this was also something that British intelligence was involved reporting to their American counterparts. Mm-hmm. So that I think there's quite a bit there. And it does seem that their relationship is shall we say, if you look at some of the emails that get quoted in some of these discussions, seems to have been a rather intimate relationship.
Between General Misha and
exactly.
Svetlana.
And Svetlana, who was involved in a number of other scandalous events, and who had an incredibly detailed knowledge of Russian espionage history with access to all sorts of highly confidential information, and parlayed that into doing a thesis at Cambridge in intelligence history. It's very, very suspicious. But I would say let's come back and focus on what does it mean for Flynn. I mean, Flynn was at that time the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. American officers, senior officers who occupy positions like that have certain duties, and they include reporting liaisons or relationships when they occur overseas, and particularly with individuals like Svetlana. You just simply have to say you had these meetings, you had these dealings, and so forth. He did not report any of this, so you've got pretty clear violations by him that would fuel suspicions about his relationship with and dealing with Russian intelligence. And of course, that's all right in the middle of this whole inquiry.
Well, just in the last minute, Scott Horton, this stuff is pretty explosive, and even if it's only a percentage of it, it's true, it ought to be enough to push this inquiry forward. So can the government, by distraction and by stunt, which is Trump's MO, when are the people going to see through it? When is the media going to stop, being jerked by the chain here and start focusing on the big ticking clock here, which is the collusion between Trump and the Russians?
Well, that is the big question right now. And I think we've gotten, and I think, all these things coming up right now, one of the questions you've got to ask is, why wasn't this developed during the election campaign?
Yeah.
These are all things that could easily have been investigated, explored, and written about during the campaign period. And instead, all the investigation seems to have started only after the election was over.
Right.
So that's a big problem. I think we're seeing, we're seeing gradual, steady movement in the polls with people more and more suspicious about what's going on. His approval numbers are historically low. The number of people demanding that there be a formal independent investigation is two-thirds of the public. The number of people suggesting he should be impeached is already approaching about 40%, and he's a person who hasn't yet served 100 days as president. That's all pretty extraordinary.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My great pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the European election monitors questioning the legitimacy of the Turkish referendum, while the winner, Turkey's new dictator for life, tells them, know your place.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nicholas Danforth, who's a senior policy analyst for the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center, where he has written widely about Turkey, U.S. foreign policy, and the Middle East. He has co-authored a new report at the Bipartisan Policy Center, Dark Cloud of Illegitimacy Hovers Over Turkey Vote. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Danforth.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, and the Council on Europe have criticized the campaigns, the government of Turkey, the extent to which the playing field was anything but level. And in terms of the dark cloud of illegitimacy, of course, it's pretty clear where the vote monitors come down. But then President Erdogan, in his typical, you know, arrogant posture, has told the vote monitors, know your place, know your place, like some sort of school mom. So that doesn't bode well, does it?
No. You know, maybe what we should have written is there are a number of dark clouds. Two in particular, I think, as you mentioned, one, even before the voting started, it was clear this wasn't going to be a legitimate referendum. The fact that people were arrested while campaigning for no, the fact of the distribution of airtime on public TV stations was so uneven, the fact that in a climate of fear where so many journalists had been arrested, no one could speak honestly about this. I mean, this was going to be an illegitimate referendum going into it. Then on top of that, you have this whole added question of were there actually irregularities in the conduct of the vote itself? Was there ballot stuffing? And when shortly after the polls closed, the Turkish Electoral Commission basically came out and said, for various reasons, we're actually going to count votes that don't have the proper markings on them, that, you know, that raised a lot of concerns, which still are very far from being answered.
Well, I mean, if you run a campaign where you basically say, I'm your savior, and I'm going to make things great and make Turkey great again. and you're all going to get rich. And by the way, the other side are a bunch of terrorists. I mean, isn't that the campaign?
Yeah. And there was a particularly remarkable moment where Erdogan actually went through the trouble of saying, I'm not saying everyone who's voting no is a terrorist, but it's worth noting that all the terrorists are voting no. I mean, that was the level of dialogue here. Exactly. And that, you know, yeah, that just makes it impossible for anyone to, you know, to think that even in the best case scenario, even if Erdogan had won with a more convincing majority, that this could actually give him the kind of legitimacy which, you know, he both craves, but then behaves in a way to make it absolutely impossible for him to achieve.
So what leverage is there? I mean, he probably, you know, in that, what, several hundred room palace that he's built for himself, he's probably in the privacy of his own thoughts, might recognize that this is not exactly a ringing endorsement. All the major cities voted against him. It's just the people in the countryside that voted for him. And then we don't know how much he rigged the vote in any case. And we certainly know that it was totally unfair. And he, you know, pulled out all the stops to rig it in his favor in the first place. So they were expecting, from what I understand, the Erdogan and the AKP people were expecting to win by over 60%, weren't they?
You know, that's the part that seems fascinating. Right. I think they honestly might have expected that they could win fairly. I mean, again, given all the previous questionable behavior. But, of course, when it became clear that they weren't going to be able to win fairly, it seems, you know, again, we're still waiting for the full evidence to come out, that they would also, well, they'd rather win it unfairly than lose. You know, right, the question if Erdogan doesn't actually, you know, come out of this with the kind of support that he wanted, the kind of confidence that he wanted, you know, how that affects his thinking. We, looking at it from the outside, obviously see the story of him increasing his power, him becoming more successfully authoritarian, eliminating any threats to his rule. But at the same time, the situation, from his point of view, probably he's much less confident in his hold on power. You know, he barely survived a coup attempt last summer. As you know, we saw from the vote, there's certainly a lot of people in the country who don't like him. And it's precisely because of that insecurity, I think, that he, you know, if you alluded to, feels still that the kind of divisive, the kind of paranoid, the kind of very aggressive politics that we've come to expect from him over the last few years are likely to continue.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Danforth, who's a senior policy analyst for the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center, who has written widely about Turkey, U.S. foreign policy, and the Middle East. He has co-authored a new report at the Bipartisan Policy Center, Dark Cloud of Illegitimacy Hovers Over Turkey Vote. So what leverage then does the rest of the world have, not to mention the 49% of people that voted against him in Turkey? I'm not sure that he cares. I mean, he's tried to demonize the rest of the world, and particularly Europe, hasn't he? I mean, he's played on
right.
sort of nationalism, and that seems to have worked to some extent. So we can expect that to continue. But in terms of the levers of leverage, if you will, what's the situation vis-a-vis refugees? Can he really cause trouble in Europe?
You know, that's a good question, right? There's been this narrative that at the end of the day, Europe's desperate to appease Erdogan because at any minute he can unleash this flood of refugees on them. This is not my area of expertise, but from what I understand, there are political circumstances out of Erdogan's control that have made Europe less attractive to refugees, have limited the number of people that would be trying to make the crossing from Turkey into Greece. Anyways, and so I think there's a sense, in European political circles that that's not quite the threat that it used to be for Erdogan.
And is there any likelihood that he will show any humility and deal more reasonably and rationally with Europe? Because it sounds like when he's threatening to bring back the death penalty, and that's a red line as far as joining the EU is concerned, what do you make of that? Do you think he's bluffing or is he serious?
Right. This seems like the biggest paradox to me, that on one hand, you certainly have people in the Turkish government that realize in the long term to make the prosperous, stable, powerful Turkey that they dream of, that they have to be on good terms with Europe. They have to have a functioning economic relationship with Europe, that they have to be pragmatic, domestically too, that they have to resolve their issue with their own Kurdish constituency. They realize all this, but at the same time, as you said, their domestic political success, their ability to win, fairly or not, referendums like this, has been a product of, very aggressive nationalistic, calling the Europeans fascists. So how Erdogan is going to be able to reconcile the kind of broader long-term foreign policy needs for the country versus his domestic political interests, which would push for a much more aggressive approach to Europe, that's going to be difficult for him to resolve. And based on what we've seen, he's going to prioritize domestic political success over the long-term good of the country.
So is there any U.S. policy here? I mean, it's difficult to find out what U.S. foreign policy is. You've got the 36-year-old son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who has most of the portfolios. I'm sure Turkey's one of them. In fact, he visited Turkey. By the way, they kept mentioning in these talks the PKK, and Jared thought that was some kind of medical issue they were talking about. He didn't even know what the acronym for PKK was. So maybe he's learned a little bit more. And Tillerson seems to be completely marginalized. So what do you know there in Washington at the Bipartisan Policy Center? What do you know about U.S. policy? And I mean, now that General Flynn's out of the picture, he took $500,000 from Erdogan's bag man. So
that's what makes it so difficult to make sense of. I mean, on one hand, the State Department's initial response after the election seemed, I thought, very good. They said, we're going to wait for the OSCE report on the election to come out before we comment. Then the report came out, was very critical, emphasized all the irregularities. And shortly afterwards, Trump called Erdogan to congratulate him. So, whatever leverage we may have had, whatever leverage the United States, I think, could have exercised by calling attention to the lack of legitimacy surrounding this referendum, the president seemed very eager to sacrifice and did so very quickly.
So he's going to let this guy stay in, not that the U.S. determines who rules Turkey, but his term of office could extend to 2034. And that's pretty unusual to begin with. So this is just Trump basically making a choice for transactional politics over democratic values?
You know, and unfortunately, I have to say, when it comes to U.S.-Turkish relations, there's a long history of that. When, you know, it was recently the anniversary of the Truman Doctrine, when the United States welcomed Turkey as an ally against the Soviet Union. And when you look at the way Truman actually phrases his speech about Greece and Turkey, welcoming them into what would eventually go on to be the NATO alliance, you know, he makes it very clear. He praises Greek democracy. And he doesn't actually ever use the word democracy in connection with Turkey. Turkey wasn't a democracy when we started giving aid to it in 1948. Subsequently, Turkey has had a series of coups on the United States. I made it clear that we prefer to see Turkey as a democracy, but we've simultaneously made it clear that being democratic is not a requirement for NATO membership, and that it's not a requirement for us to continue having good relations with Turkey, as long as, and I guess this is an important caveat, they're supporting our foreign policy interests. And so the question, you know, now will be, given that, you know, there's a lot of grounds for the U.S. and Turkey to work together, there are also a lot of areas where we don't see eye to eye. And what I'm worried about is that it may be, you know, if Turkey stops doing what we want in northern Syria against ISIS, then in a very hypocritical way, we might belatedly pull out this democracy card for more instrumental rather than principled reasons.
Well, clearly we tolerated, if not encouraged, these military governments, right? And that was the
exactly.
unfortunate legacy. And, of course, that more recent coup, as amateurish as it was, reminded everybody of that long struggle for democracy. But that in itself makes you scratch your head and wonder, why did the Turkish people sign away their democracy?
You know, I think that's one of the things that when you look at the way, well, I guess when you look at the way this looks to people in Turkey, for, you know, diehard Erdogan supporters, they've, in the past, they've seen the threat to their democracy come from the military. You know, we don't know the details of the coup last summer, but they've seen the threat to their democracy come from, you know, most likely members of the Gulen movement. And they've seen, because of this history, because of the kinds of threats that Turkish democracy has faced in the past, they've come to see Erdogan as the, you know, the one protecting their democracy against those threats. And so, you know, even as he stops behaving democratically or starts behaving in a, you know, what at best could be called a very illiberal majoritarian style of government, they, you know, they nonetheless see him as the kind of democratic alternative, the manifestation of the will of the people in the face of these myriad threats. You know, fewer and fewer people, I think, continue to see it that way. But, you know, the numbers who still did were just close enough that maybe with some fudging, they added up to 51.5%.
So what do you think the 49%, which might well have been a majority because of the vote rigging and the fact that these unmarked, unstamped ballots, suddenly they decided to, I mean, how could you do that? You know, it was a pretty simple ballot, wasn't it? You had yes or no, and you stamped one box or the other. And how would they allow unstamped ballots to be counted? Did they just decide where to put the stamp?
Yeah, so the argument was that because a couple election officials hadn't been properly trained, they submitted ballots that hadn't been properly stamped. And that because the Electoral Commission was so concerned that by not counting these improperly stamped ballots, they disenfranchised, you know, however many couple hundred people might have been in these districts where the election officials made this mistake. The only response to this, the only fair thing to do would be to, you know, basically change longstanding electoral law and open up the ballots to any, you know, and again, there's no evidence that, well, that's the point. No one knows, you know. There are a lot of things that could be on these unstamped ballots, and once you open that up, there's no longer any mechanism, I mean, that's what the stamp was supposed to be for, to ensure that the ballots that are being counted are ones that were legitimately cast and not ones that were stuffed into a box somewhere.
But again, going back to the minority who lost narrowly but could well have been a majority because of the rigging that took place. And certainly, had there been a level playing field in terms of the other side being able to campaign, have access to the media, not be operating in a climate of oppression and fear, with journalists being jailed right, left and center, and anybody that campaigned for the No campaign was called a terrorist and likened to a terrorist. What do the urban, educated Turks do now? How do they, I mean, they can't possibly put up with this guy until 2034.
Well, you know, I think a lot of the near future, you know, Turkey's stability certainly in the next couple of years is going to depend on how people who are unhappy with this result respond. And, you know, there's certainly some people were talking about how there'd be large protests if the evidence of fraud looks more obvious. Then you certainly could have people coming out on the street, which, you know, the government might deal with very harshly. At the same time, you know, seem to have a lot of people who are willing to hunker down, resign themselves to the fact that they don't have any good options for fighting back. You have a lot of people who are, you know, making plans to leave the country. So I guess in the short term, you know, a lot depends on how people respond. In the longer term, too, you know, Turkey's going to face, it could potentially face economic crises. It could, you know, I mean, particularly a looming economic crisis, given some of the indicators, could have an ongoing war against the PKK. You know, there are a lot of things that, you know, even if there is some short-term stability, even if, you know, the immediate aftermath of the referendum, the opposition is kind of resigned to Erdogan's victory, you know, there are still things that could destabilize the situation in the medium term.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Nicholas Danforth.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Danforth, who's a senior policy analyst for the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He has written widely about Turkey, the U.S. foreign policy, and the Middle East, and has co-authored a new report at the Bipartisan Policy Center, Dark Cloud of Illegitimacy Hovers Over Turkey Vote. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into alternatives to the collision course the U.S. is on with North Korea. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adam Mount, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on nuclear security. Previously, he was a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and worked on nuclear elimination contingencies at the RAND Corporation. He is the project director at the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by Admiral Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and former Senator Sam Nunn, who have issued a new report, A Sharper Choice on North Korea, Engaging China for a Stable Northeast Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Mount.
Thank you.
And there are, of course, heated rhetoric coming out of North Korea. That's not exactly new, but North Korea's Deputy United Nations Ambassador said today that the U.S. has created a dangerous situation in which a thermonuclear war may break out at any minute. And of course, Vice President Mike Pence is in South Korea warning North Korea not to test again, saying, reiterating that the era of strategic patience is over. So what can be done? To the New York Times did a piece, I think it was yesterday, suggesting that this may be a kind of Cuban missile crisis in slow motion. Let's start with that premise. Do you agree with that possibility or that portent?
Well, it's an interesting analogy, isn't it? There are things that are similar about the Cuban Missile Crisis and things that are different. What's similar is that the choices that we face, the choices between striking enemy emplacements that could lead to a broader nuclear war, which nobody wants, negotiating a solution, or trying to find ways to contain those deployments and still meet American and allied national security interests. So it's a tough choice, but the choices are similar. What's different about it is that North Korea is much more invested in the deployment of their nuclear and missiles than the Soviets were in their deployment of missiles to Cuba. North Korea sees their nuclear program as safeguarding their own national sovereignty and vital for their national security. And so it's not going to be easy to give them up. Another difference is that the U.S. president now is publicly disdainful of the kind of tough diplomacy that President Kennedy practiced to get the Soviets to withdraw their missiles from Cuba. He's said that the Iran deal was the worst deal that the United States has ever done, which is clearly an exaggeration. And that kind of inflexibility won't serve him well if he's interested in finding ways to limit North Korea's nuclear and missile program. So he's going to have to find ways to talk to the regime if he's interested in changing their military posture.
So just continuing then the Cuban Missile Crisis analogy, would Donald Trump be more closer to General Curtis LeMay than Jack Kennedy?
Well, you would get folks here in Washington agreeing and disagreeing with that analogy. Trump clearly holds he holds an affection for bluster, for expansive rhetoric, something that General LeMay was known for. But thus far, his administration has taken a step back from the possibility of striking North Korea in retaliation for a nuclear or missile test. They've sent contradictory signals about that. One of the dangers is that Trump finds that he has backed himself into a corner with his own rhetoric. So I believe it was during the transition that he posted on Twitter to say that North Korea will not achieve the possibility of placing a nuclear warhead atop an intercontinental ballistic missile that could strike at the continental United States. If he thinks that his credibility depends on that promise, he could find himself backed into a corner where he no longer has options other than war. So when politics gets injected into strategic bargaining, accidents can happen. So that's something that we ought to be aware of.
So the North Koreans, of course, are now, their test fizzled yesterday, but now they're saying that they will test a missile weekly. I talked to an analyst yesterday who suggested that perhaps what they're doing is they're firing off all of their old liquid-fueled missiles now that they've moved to solid-fueled in terms of the medium-range missiles. Is there a possibility that that's what they're doing, that they just know that this antagonizes us, so they keep doing it?
Well, there has been a pattern of North Korea testing missiles periodically. We can never be quite sure why they're testing when. One model is to suggest that they test when they're technologically ready, when they have when they've developed a new missile system that requires testing to make it work. But on the other hand, sometimes North Koreans clearly test on symbolic occasions. And the test 2 days ago was just like this. It was the North Korean Day of the Sun, which is an enormous holiday in North Korea. And the day after, they chose to test what Western intelligence sources are now telling Fox News was a KN-17. That's a liquid fuel Scud variant, but they wouldn't assign a new designation unless it was a new variant. So I guess the answer to your question is that they test, they're clearly making rapid progress in their missile programs. They're testing more frequently, and they're testing a greater variety of missiles than at any time in the past. And with the new designation of a KN-17, it seems clear that they're continuing to innovate. So while not all of their tests have been successful, it's clear that they are still making progress.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Mount, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on nuclear security. Previously, he was a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and worked on nuclear elimination contingencies at the RAND Corporation. He's the project director at the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, and former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, who have issued a new report, A Sharper Choice on North Korea, Engaging China for a Stable Northeast Asia. So let's just briefly go through the points in the report, Adam Mount, and just briefly, one, promote a stable and prosperous Northeast Asia, two, restructure negotiations, three, protect human rights, four, enforce sanctions and escalate financial pressure, and five, strengthen deterrence and defense. So let's start with the last one. I spoke the other day with the former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Donald Gregg, who was also Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor, Korea CIA officer. He says that we do have deterrence with North Korea, that they're not suicidal. So let's begin with that.
We absolutely do have a robust deterrent posture towards North Korea. It's something that we focus on every day. U.S. and South Korean our militaries on the peninsula are integrated in what's called a combined forces command. So there are 28,500 American men and women, and their unofficial motto in U.S. Forces Korea is that they're ready to fight tonight. That's no joke. That's no exaggeration. They really are prepared to defend against and to respond to any aggression that the North Koreans can offer. But that doesn't mean that the picture is static. North Korea, as their nuclear and missile programs advance, they're also advancing in other ways. They are fielding more special operations forces, developing submarine capabilities to aggress in the maritime environment. Their cyber aggressions and intrusions into Western banking systems is just one example. There was also a story that reported that they recently hacked U.S. Forces Command in South Korea and perhaps made off with portions of outdated operational plans. The point is that they are capable of aggressing at various levels on this spectrum of conflict. And so it's not just enough to say that we can repulse and resist a conventional invasion. We need to be prepared to defend against and respond to credibly all of these different kinds of aggressive signals. So there are in some ways more that we can do. One example is that more U.S. naval force structure could be really very valuable. More missile defense. You just saw us deploy the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System, THAAD, to the peninsula as a way of knocking down North Korean missiles that could be fired towards Seoul. These are the kinds of capabilities that we need to continue to improve to maintain deterrence, because it's not a static target.
But what about deterrence in terms of North Korea? The idea that's often been floated is that Kim Jong-un is crazy and unstable and mercurial, and therefore you don't have the normal stability that mutually assured destruction gives you.
Well, the question of nuclear deterrence is even more complicated. In a case like Russia, the U.S. and Russian arsenals are fairly symmetrical. There are some gradations in where they place their emphasis and where we place ours, but we have a similar number of weapons, and we both concede that we are mutually vulnerable to each other. So we have a mutually assured destruction posture. That's not the case in North Korea. We don't accept mutual vulnerability with North Korea. We don't accept them as a nuclear state. So figuring out how to do deterrence under these circumstances, and to maintain stability, right, to deter aggression at lower levels of escalation, like in the cyber domain, like with special operations forces, is a complex challenge. It's not as simple as saying that we have nuclear weapons, so therefore North Korea will sit on their hands. They've continually proven motivated in trying to find cracks and gaps in allied defenses to try to score points where they can. So, like I say, it's a moving target, and it's not a simple answer.
So is that then to say that the massive nuclear arsenal and the massive capabilities of the U.S. and the South Koreans still doesn't deter North Korea from possibly, you know, we know that they've shelled islands and they've sunk ships and they've sent hit teams in, one of which killed the former, actually the outgoing head of South Korea's mother, trying to target, of course, the president of South Korea at the time. So how do you explain that? That on the one hand, Donald Gregg says they're not suicidal. On the other hand, they do some pretty provocative things.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think what we're getting at is saying that deterrence is not a unitary entity. You can't just establish deterrence and expect a country to be deterred from any kind of aggressive activity at all. Deterrence is variegated. You need to find ways of deterring specific actions. So, for example, we have manifestly failed at deterring North Korea from testing their nuclear arsenal or developing their missile programs. That's another thing that this administration is going to have to learn. After North Korea did not test a nuclear weapon this weekend, the administration made signs, for example, that suggested that the military moves that they have made towards the peninsula prevented them from doing that, deterred them from doing that. Now, when North Korea inevitably does test a missile and most likely tests another nuclear weapon, they can't be surprised by that because deterrence is not unitary. So we need to find ways of deterring other kinds of actions day in, day out. It's a constant challenge.
Well, at this point, China, I mean, the president said he had a really good conversation with President Xi of China recently down in Mar-a-Lago at his retreat in Florida. Some people are suggesting that actually Xi educated Trump about some of the basics about the Chinese relationship with North Korea, that one, the Chinese don't like the regime and they never have, and two, the North Koreans don't like the Chinese. And since then, we know that the coal ships have been turned back and airline travel has been curtailed. So what will the effect be of putting the squeeze on if indeed China sticks with this policy? Are they going to relent, or at least they may not give in to U.S. demands, but will they give in to Chinese demands, if indeed the Chinese are making demands? I guess we don't know.
So there are two questions here. The first question is whether the United States can encourage China to place more pressure on North Korea. The second question is, if they did, what difference would it make? So with respect to the first, as you've noted, China is sending mixed signals. They're clearly not where they were 5 or 10 years ago. They're clearly more interested in placing pressure on North Korea. And I believe that there are members within the regime or within the Chinese leadership that are increasingly coming to see North Korea as a threat to regional stability rather than as a guarantor of regional stability, as a buffer against American power. And so they are sending more signals. They are signing on to increasingly assertive UN Security Council resolutions that restrict North Korean trading rights, for example. But on the other hand, they just released the other day numbers that showed that their trade with North Korea is increasing. So it's not one way or the other. But there is an opportunity here to convince China that the U.S. and Chinese interests, in fact, overlap on North Korea, that we're both interested in restraining their nuclear and missile programs and aggressive behavior. Now, even if China did lean on North Korea, as hard as that question is, it's even more difficult to imagine what difference it would make. North Korea, as their nuclear and missile programs have advanced, the price has gone up. And it may not be possible now to expect negotiations to start from the premise of an elimination of their nuclear weapons arsenal. So we're going to have to, if we do get back into negotiations, find ways to work up to that. So you might start from an agreement that has to do with stability or arms control on the peninsula, and then work your way up to denuclearization talks. That's the kind of flexibility that Donald Trump has not exhibited so far in international diplomacy, but it's what would be necessary.
Well, just in closing, Adam Mount, what about the possibility, though, you know, they always talk about thinking outside of the box, but it would seem to me that if the U.S. and the South Koreans were to basically just completely forget about a military solution. And they have these ridiculous talks at Panmunjom where they go through this ritual. They have been doing that since 1953. But what say the U.S. actually put a peace treaty on the table and said, look, let's just get, you know, the war's not ended. Let's get a peace treaty. We'll recognize you and we don't want to bother you and we withdraw our troops and let's just sign a peace treaty. Wouldn't that completely undercut the Kim regime? Because doesn't it, the glue that holds that regime together is this paranoia, which they can't constantly pump out.
Right.
From the day that kids are born to, you know, cradle to grave, they're told the Americans are coming, the Americans are coming. What say the Americans refuse to be the enemy anymore? What would happen?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. The best hope that we have for moderating North Korea's behavior is to do exactly that, is to find ways of moderating the regime's behavior in exchange for concessions. In some of these cases, they are military concessions. Now, U.S. forces on the peninsula are not going to leave until the threat from North Korea ameliorates or decreases. But at the same time, we could talk about moderating U.S.-South Korean exercises, and then we could look forward to a future in which the United States does not need forces on the peninsula because North Korea is denuclearized. It's not clear, as you suggest, that North Korea is interested in a deal like that because it's the paranoia that maintains internal control. But I think it's a conversation that's worth having and it's worth working toward. But there, you know, as you said, there are no good options here.
Well, Adam Mount, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Mount, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on nuclear security. Previously, he was a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and worked on nuclear elimination contingencies at the RAND Corporation. He is the project director at the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, and former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, who have issued a new report, A Sharper Choice on North Korea, Engaging China for a Stable Northeast Asia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.